Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the 101st episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, here with my two compatriots. There's Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Welcome, Brian.
And there's Nick Newman, associate editor of The Film Stage.
Hello.
We're also joined on our 101st episode by a very special guest. It is our editor-in-chief, our benevolent benefactor, Jordan Raup.
Hello. Glad to be back on.
Yeah, he's back.
Yes.
This is excellent because we'll be able to get kind of a part two of a behind-the-scenes look at this came apart. It hasn't happened yet. How this came to be. Before we get into that, though, let me tell you what we'll be talking about today. For our feature review, we will be talking about Ida, the newest film by the newest film by Pavel Pavlikovsky. We will also be talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, directed by Mark Webb and starring Andrew Garfield as the titular web slinger. Before we get into those, we will have a brief rundown of our three most anticipated films of the summer. And it's going to be a good show. I'm glad you all are here. Now let's go to the phones. We got an email after our last podcast. So we wanted to give a shout-out to Stephen Ron, who said that he's been listening to us since our review of To the Wonder. Apparently, a lot of people picked us up during our To the Wonder podcast, which is great, because it's the one that Danny and Nick have both denounced. But he says he doesn't think he's laughed harder than when I summed up Labor Day as, "It is preposterous, it is saccharine, it is manipulative, it is effective." So glad we could give you a chuckle there. He's also very excited to hear a drunk episode on the Ninth Gate. We're now also talking about maybe doing a drunk episode on Labor Day, so get excited for that. Odds are that these will be drunk commentaries, not drunk reviews, but we're working out the logistics. We also don't know what we'll be drinking yet, but expect a lot of whiskey product placement from me. So thank you, Stephen, for writing in. Thank you, everyone, who's been following us on Twitter and retweeting and favoriting and commenting. Great to hear from you guys. And 101 episodes. It wasn't a joke. This is still happening. Speaking of which, Jordan Raup.
Yes.
Why don't you just walk us through what you were thinking when you decided to make this happen?
Oh, I have no idea. I was on a bender and it was just, yeah. No, we did a podcast when we first, like in the very early incarnation of the site, with between Dan and I, who he's been on the podcast, I think it only lasted, I think we did like 15 episodes, but it was just kind of like an experiment. I don't think anyone listened, and then we took like a pretty long break, but we wanted to get something together with someone who could kind of make it their main focus and more dedicated. And I found you, Brian, and you were the solution to everything. And I knew Nick and Danny would be perfect compatriots, and it's just been beautiful ever since.
All right. Well, that's glorious.
Quite positive comments.
Is it true what Nick said last week that you'd never heard my voice before we actually like slotted in the first episode?
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, because I figured you guys would record. I would listen. And if it was horrible, I would just never talk to any of you guys again. Just delete all of your contact information. But it was great. And as soon as I heard that sweet, smooth voice of yours, I was hooked. So,
all right,
there it was. Yeah,
fantastic. So there's our sequel to last week's discussion. Before we get into our first discussion topic and then the reviews, I'd like to just do a little bit of housekeeping. As always, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you have something you'd like to say to us that you'd like us to read on the air. You can also give us ratings and comments at iTunes, so just look up The Film Stage Show and do that. We always read those on the air, and that's always a trip. You can also get us at thefilmstage.com, find the podcasts tab, and you will be able to comment on those, and we're constantly monitoring that to be able to talk back to you. And, of course, you can follow us on Twitter, at FilmStageShow. Also, something to keep your ears out for towards the end of this episode, we will be telling you how you can win a Blu-ray of Touch of Sin, which is a movie that I think got name-checked on one of our top 10 lists. I want to say it was Nick?
I think it was Danny's as well.
Oh, Nick and Danny's. All right.
I know Danny liked it.
Danny, do you recall?
Yeah, that was on my top 10. Okay. Really good film. Yeah.
Two out of three Film Stage Show hosts agree that this is one of the top 10 films of last year, and we're going to tell you how you can win a Touch of Sin Blu-ray. So keep your ears open. That'll be coming later in the episode. So let's get into our first discussion, which is our top three each summer anticipated films. So, Jordan Raup, you're our esteemed guest. Why don't you kick us off with one of yours?
Sure. So first up, I will go with The Rover, which is kind of one of the big indie releases that has yet to be screened at festivals. It will be at Cannes. So we'll get first reactions there. And then thankfully, unlike a lot of movies that premiere at Cannes, it will be hitting theaters just about a month later on June 13th. But this is David McCode, I think. And he is part of the Blue Tongue Film Collective in...
Mishad.
Okay, thank you.
Wait, the Blue Tongue Film Collective, is that based off of the Blue Tongue Skink?
I do not think so, but it is...
I'm looking this up. Hold on.
It's a group of Australian filmmakers who kind of have been creating these like dark noirish thrillers that are all really good. And so his movie Animal Kingdom was a part of this. Nash Edgerton's movie The Square, which is also how Joel Edgerton became a prominence starring in these movies. I think he had a hand in writing some of them. But anyway, so this one it stars Guy Pearce, who was also in Animal Kingdom. Briefly, and also Robert Pattinson, who is continuing his streak of actually being in impressive movies in a post Twilight. So it's kind of like this. It takes place a few years in the future, which is kind of interesting, which isn't really hinted at like in the trailer. So I don't know how that exactly plays in to the movie, but I've honestly kept away from a lot of the stuff with it because I'm pretty excited. But I think it's something about Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson, like his car gets stolen and he has to team with Guy Pearce, and it just looks like just crazy darkness wrapped in like a road trip movie, which is all in the Australian outback. So I think you guys talked about Wake and Fright. Hopefully it's like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is one of my top three as well. Yeah. So I'll just second everything that you've said.
Cool.
Plus I'll watch anything that Guy Pearce is in.
Yep.
Which was actually the impetus behind me reviewing Hate Ship, Love Ship.
Oh, yeah.
Which was actually a good movie. Check it out. All right, Danny King, what about yourself? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, yes. I'm happy to offer that information. a few, I guess, honorable mentions first. Definitely Jersey Boys. The first Clint in 3 years. So that's a big deal. I got really excited when that trailer debuted. Like, it's one of the only trailers I've watched online kind of on my own conviction in a while. So that was enjoyable. I'm also really looking forward to Palo Alto, which comes out very soon. So it doesn't make much sense to put that on my list. And then another film, We Are the Best, the newest film by Lucas Moodysson. I was looking forward to this film. And then a couple weeks ago, if you remember that film from last year, This is Martin Bonner, the director of that movie, Chad Hartigan, did a Letterboxd entry on We Are the Best. And he wrote, it's been out less than a year and I've only seen it twice, but I have no qualms calling this miracle of a movie one of the greatest ever made.
Holy God.
Yeah, which is like insane. And Chad Hartigan, you know, is a guy who has clearly seen a lot of movies that are probably, you know, more significant than We Are the Best. So I'm kind of curious, like, why he thinks it's one of the greatest movies ever made. So I would call that an honorable mention also. And then for my number three...
We're really only supposed to do one, but just keep going.
Really? One honorable mention?
No, like, Oh, okay. So you just did your honorable mentions first.
Yeah.
You maniac. Anyway, go ahead.
Number three would be A Most Wanted Man, because I really liked Anton Corbijn's previous film, The American, but mostly just to see the next Philip Seymour Hoffman performance. And from what I can tell, it probably seems like the most demanding performance left in like his remaining films. So very eager to see that.
I saw it. It is okay.
It's okay, right?
It's a little bit of a letdown, yeah.
I was about to say, I remember hearing that it was a bit of a letdown.
So. Is it a good role for him?
It's still a good movie. Yeah, he's the best part about it. What I found most disappointing was, like, I was hoping a little bit of, like, Anton Corbijn's, like, sensibilities in his other two movies came out.
Yeah.
But it's more, like hoping, like, it would be like, kind of like a Tinker Tailor type movie in terms of the approach, and it's much more conventional in terms of his visual style. But, yeah, it's good. It's very interesting in terms of how, like the minute little details that add up to solve like the case they're working on. So anyways, that it's good, but not one of my favorites of the summer.
All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Okay, well, I think my number three selection will be Norte, The End of History by Lav Diaz. This is, why are you laughing?
Just because.
Okay.
Because I swear to God, this is the only podcast that you'll go on where we'll talk about our most anticipated films this summer, and someone will bring up this.
Brian, come on. It's a 250-minute movie that'll be released in one theater. Everyone is looking forward to this.
Right. Yeah. No, it's great.
So, this is a film I'm looking forward to. I've never actually seen a Lav Diaz film because they're all 6 hours long and only play at film festivals and pretty much never get released. But this is really going to be one of the first opportunities I've had to see one of his movies, short of downloading a 6 gigabyte file to my computer. So that itself is kind of part of the appeal. I'm really not 100% sure what to expect. One of our contributors and frequent guest, Ethan Vespi, saw it at TIFF last September, and he loved it, and it was on his top 10 of the year. And I was talking to him. I actually had a chance that we were just kind of chatting about it when I met him in October, and he kind of said it, you know, it's a film that really puts you under this spell for 4 hours, and it does so through surprisingly conventional, or not conventional, surprisingly classical methods. And it is maybe that's fitting because it's actually a reinterpretation of Crime and Punishment, which you would not get from the trailer, which is just these very beautiful, very crisp images and sort of these all natural sounds of nature, sounds of people walking. And because of that, I really, you know, I'm not entirely sure what to expect, but I will have a chance to finally see a Lav Diaz film and in a theater, and that's just a good thing on its own. I'm sure everyone else is just feeling the exact same way about it. I'm sure there will be plenty of other film podcasts that put this on their most anticipated summer list. So sorry for playing it conventional, guys, but
I know that was a really safe choice.
It's actually funny. I had to like fact check a piece on Norte for an internship. So it was like a really weird way to watch it because I had to like pause it every 30 seconds to like screen cap dialogue to confirm that. I've like seen it, but I don't even kind of think that I've seen it, you know, because it's just such a tough viewing experience. And I was like in an office, so there are like scenes like there are scenes of violence or whatever, so it's just like a really awkward way to watch a 4-hour movie.
Yeah.
All right, Jordan Raup, number two.
Yes, I'm gonna go with Snowpiercer, which is the much awaited film by Bong Joon-ho,
which will be released uncut.
Yes, uncut, thankfully, but because it's not gonna, I think it's gonna be released, yeah, June 27th, I think, is the release date for that, and it's going to be pretty limited, but it's also going to be, I think it's going to be Radius, if I'm not mistaken, which means it'll get VOD, treatment.
Nice.
So, yeah. So
unless they do the immigrant thing where they take it back 2 weeks before it's supposed to come out.
This movie, if you followed our site, we've posted endlessly about it, so I'm sure you know what it's about.
Yeah, we had a whole discussion about it and cutting films and stuff on this.
Oh, right. Yeah, so, yeah, see this instead of Transformers. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this as well. It didn't make my list, though. Actually, Nick Newman mentioned the one that I'm going to have as my number two, and that is The Immigrant.
Oh yeah,
because we talked. This is another one that we talked about. It feels like a year ago. And
yeah.
I am still looking forward to it.
It's a good movie. It's only grown in my estimation, I think, since I saw it. So.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's very good.
All right.
It would be
very good. Yeah.
It'd be on my list, but since I've seen it,
oh,
I feel
like it doesn't count.
Yeah.
Dick. Danny King, what's your number two film?
My number two. I feel like this is continuing like a morbid theme of films about people that have died recently, but it would be Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary. Probably just speaks for itself why I would be looking forward to that film.
Directed by Steve James.
Yeah, so Steve James is great. And Word seemed good out of Sundance. It's sort of an impossible movie to like.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's good.
But I mean, like, it's weird to try to sit back and think like, oh yeah, critics enjoyed Life Itself, you know, just because.
Yeah, that was a really interesting press screening because it was.
Was it?
Yeah, because I didn't go to the premiere, but I went to, like, at Sundance, they always have the press screenings, like, the day after or so. And so, yeah, we went, and it was just really, because a lot of, some people in the screening are referenced in the movie. And, but anyways, it was just very, there was, you will definitely tear up if Roger Ebert had any sort of impact on your life, which I assume he did with you guys.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and it's a really balanced, really in-depth, look at his life. But what's also interesting is I guess at Cannes they're gonna like they added a new section, so I wonder if that's gonna be out in the theatrical cut, because they added this how Roger Ebert was so influential at Cannes, I guess, so his time there, I guess they added a whole section about that, but so I'd like to see that.
Yeah,
but what was there was great. So
all right, yeah. Nick Newman,
my second most anticipated film of the summer will be a relatively, I think at this point, well-publicized title, and that is The Double by Richard Ayoade. I still don't know how to pronounce it.
Ayoade?
Yeah, so like peyote, I guess?
Yeah, I think so.
I still honestly don't really know how to pronounce his name, but either way, that guy, who you all are somewhat familiar with, I saw Submarine back in, I guess it was November of 2011, and I really loved it.
Yeah, I love Submarine.
A film that I think it's sort of kind of like the film Beginners as well, which came out the same year. A movie that I should probably, by most accounts, really intensely dislike. And yet, it just does very specific things which appeal to me.
Dude, if you didn't like Beginners,
emotionally and aesthetically,
I would just shut down this whole podcast.
Right. No, I was rewatching some of Beginners the other night, and or maybe like a week ago, and I was just... I wasn't crying, but I was just really, man, that, I don't know.
That's,
okay.
That's basically how I watch that movie, is like right on the edge.
Yeah. So, The Double, anyway, is sort of a, I wouldn't say it's Kafka-esque, because it's actually adapting Dostoevsky, but it is an adaptation of a Dostoevsky novella in which a man discovers that his double was working in his office, and very few people seem to treat this as an odd occurrence, and yet he is naturally freaked out and finds his world crumbling. That alone, having two Jesse Eisenbergs going up against one another, I am very intrigued by. But as someone who was really a big fan of Submarine and actually thinks that Ayoade shows incredible skill and incredible promise as a filmmaker, someone who I think could grow in really fascinating ways, I can't wait to see how it is he might have grown. It seems like this is really taking a left turn with its Brazil-esque design and with perhaps more psychological thriller horror elements as well. This is a movie I really can't wait for.
It is fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I've been hearing good things since September, really. It's been a bit of a long wait, and I'm glad that it'll not only be coming out within 6 days of this recording, but it'll also be coming out on VOD, so I can just put it on my television set and fly back and...
Yeah. I will say, if you're going to see it, definitely don't just like rent it and then kind of, not that you should do this with any movie, but don't just rent it and read a book while you're watching it or something. Because there is like every single shot in this movie has either a hilarious gag or something that's like integral to the plot, or it's just brilliant. Like this, the visuals and also the sound design is amazing. So that's if you can see it in the theater, definitely go for that,
because right.
The sound design is just so good.
What if I read the Dostoevsky novella while I watch it?
That would be an interesting experiment. Yeah.
Shocking.
That would be sort of its own doubling.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, Jordan Raup, what's your most anticipated film of the summer?
I actually haven't really. These are just three. I haven't been counting
down.
Well,
but give us the pile. One you saved for last.
Well, before I say this, I will say Boyhood, which I've also been posting about like crazy on the film stage, is amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, that would be number one with a bullet. But I've seen it and I can't wait to see it again. So I'm going to go with another one. The Congress, which is probably not really publicized at all yet. I think they just announced a release date like a week ago. But it is in fact coming this summer. Premiered at Cannes last year. It is Ari Folman's follow-up to Waltz with Bashir, which I believe won the Oscar.
I believe it did, yes.
Yeah. And instead of, this is not strictly, this has animation in it, but it's not strictly animated like that movie. It is, I think, yeah, Rafi reviewed, who's been on the podcast. I think he actually probably talked about it last, a year ago.
I think he did. This sounds familiar.
But yeah, it is, looks absolutely crazy. It's about, it's a kind of a meta movie about, Robin Wright, she's an actress, I think, in the film. And yeah, and it's about her, like the movie goes into her imagination and along with all of her fears. And yeah, it looks crazy. Paul Giamatti's in it, Harvey Keitel. If you've seen even like a clip of the animation, there's a bunch of different styles at play. So I, out of Cannes, it was kind of a mixed bag, but the people I loved it really did. And so, yeah, so it just looks kind of one of the more weirder, interesting films to be released. And I think, yeah, Draft House is putting it out, so I think it should be on VOD as well. I think it's August 29th or 27th it comes out. So can't wait for that.
Sweet. All right. I am going to go probably, I guess, the most mainstream thing we'll have on here. I'm really looking forward to Godzilla.
Wow.
Like, there's a new trailer out for this. I think it's the Asian trailer, which sounds reductive, but that's what everyone's been posting it as. So, there's a new trailer out, and it's amazing. And it's just, they've done a really swell job marketing this movie. Like, really knocking it out of the park. And there's just a point at the end where, I guess, like, I don't know what the plot of the movie is, but from what I've been able to suss out, I guess, like, some monsters are attacking everywhere. And so, rather than, like, it's a great B-movie plot, if this is what it is. But at some point, they're like, you know who could really help us out here? Godzilla. And Ken Watanabe just stares out into the mid-distance and says, "Let them fight." And I just, like, I wanted to, like, throw my computer across the room and just be like, "You're goddamn right!"
Did you do that?
Or? I didn't. I came close, though. I literally texted a friend who told me to look at this trailer, and I texted her, and then I just had that quote, and then I said, "Fuck yeah." So I can't wait to see this. I'm really excited. I want like a bit. It's summer, guys. Come on. It's the time for big movies and monsters and stuff.
Brian, remember what happened when you got hyped about a movie, a monster movie last summer?
And then I got like the wrath of the internet because yeah. I didn't like it that much. And that's what I'm hoping. I hope that this does everything right that Pacific Rim did wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna put my stamp on that. So that's mine. So Danny King, what about yourself?
My number one is actually Pacific Rim.
I plan on rewatching it.
1 year anniversary Blu-ray release. I can't wait.
So yeah, that'll. I like rented out the AMC near me, so it'll be a big. No, my number one is Boyhood, definitely. So anything I'd say would just be redundant. But you know, as a Linklater fan and as someone who finds the concept rather amazing, just very eager to see it.
All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Yeah, my number one is also Boyhood, Richard Linklater motion picture. I've come to calling it Goyhood, just as sort of a Jewish, non-Jewish joke. Goyhood, anybody?
Okay, I get it.
There's no one in the movie that's Jewish, though, I don't think.
Okay, well, it takes place in Texas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
What?
But I think I first read about this movie in something like 2007, so... that it's my most anticipated of the summer doesn't mean I'm necessarily dying to see it. It's just that it almost wins by default because I've known about it
because
longer.
Because you've been anticipating it literally for the most time. The most. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just wins just by matter of duration. And I actually have not watched the trailer. I am disgusted.
Don't do it.
I'm disgusted by people who watch the trailer for this film. And I can't even look at photos from this movie. I've seen photos of the kid when he's
in
I've seen that, but I've seen photos of the kid.
Spoilers, that is the opening shot, so that's all you need to know.
Is it really?
It's the whole movie right there.
Okay. I've seen photos of the kid when he's no longer a kid, and that to me
ruined.
Felt like, honestly, I saw
that's
that.
That's the twist.
And I thought, this is too much. And so I... Yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely looking forward to it, and it'll come out soon enough. It opens on July 11th. I might see it at the BAM Cinema Fest before that, a few weeks before.
Oh, you're cool. Whoa.
Yeah.
Lord.
And I guess if it wins by duration, so be it, but I do like Richard Linklater, so that as well. I mean, yeah, just, I don't need to say any more. Fuck it. Boyhood.
It's all right.
Can I mention just... like quickly, just a few more that should be on your radar for our listeners.
Yes,
I won't go in depth. But the new Woody Allen movie, Magic in the Moonlight, which no one has seen yet, but hopefully is good. Borgman is so good. I just watched the screener of it. It's very odd. If you like Dogtooth, Michael Haneke, it's like a funny version of Funny Games.
Okay.
If you didn't find Funny Games funny,
Funny Games is a little funny.
Funny Games is hilarious.
All right. And then
I laughed my ass off at Funny Games. Anyway,
yeah, that comes out June 6th, and then Woody Allen's movie comes out July 25th, and then in August, Frank, which stars Michael Fassbender, but he wears a paper mache head the whole time. But it's a good movie.
Okay.
And then the last one is Obvious Child, which comes out in early June.
Is that A24?
Do you just want to name the rest
that's
of
it,
the
that's
40
it. No,
list
no, no,
that
no,
we
no,
have
no.
on the film station?
No, no, no. Those are like the major, major ones. So that's all.
Okay.
But it's an abortion comedy, so.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, but really well done.
Can I throw out some honorable mentions?
Oh, my God. Why not?
We don't even need
to review any movies this day.
one film I have seen, which is going to open in August, is Simon Lang's Stray Dogs, which I talked about all the way back in our New York Film Festival episode like 6 months ago. That film's incredible. It was number two on my top 10 of last year. I think that film is probably going to land like an atomic bomb, honestly. Yeah, it's really amazing, and I can't wait to see it again on a big screen because I saw it on my fucking TV, and it really kind of demands to be seen on a large setting. So that as well, that would be on my list, like The Immigrant as well, which I'm looking forward to rewatching. So there's those two. Also, I'm very excited for Dawn. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, God. Did you like the first one?
Yeah, I did.
Did we talk about the first one?
No, we didn't. Mercifully, we didn't have a show then.
Okay.
But
well, I can't wait to talk whatever the fuck this one is.
Yeah, I can't wait because they're riding horses and Gary Oldman is screaming into a megaphone. I just, as a big fan of the Planet of the Apes series, genuinely a big fan. This isn't some winking cute thing. I genuinely think it's like fucking great. So... I mean, granted, like at least two of the films are really quite bad, but
Keri Russell's in it. She's great on The Americans. I guess that could be
Toby Kebbell reprising his role from The Counselor.
Oh, great.
So Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I'm really looking forward to. And
Jason
also,
Clark. I like Jason Clarke.
Yeah.
So. And it's Matt Reeves. I had a lot of problems with the first movie, and I'm hoping to like this one. Because, again, you've named a lot of things that I could get behind.
Mm-hmm. Palo Alto from Gia Coppola, the newest Coppola Childs, who's making the video. Supposed to be very good, heard very good things, has a fine trailer. And kind of looking forward to Jersey Boys. I am frequently hit and miss, mixed on Clint Eastwood. But
I love
guess,
Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons.
No, I can't stand Frankie Valli in the
what?
Four Seasons.
No, oh, come on.
No, I hate them. And
what? Nick?
Yeah.
Why?
So, which is makes my curiosity strange, but then again, it is curiosity. I think
how can
that
you hate Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons
because it's awful, and it's driven by baby boomer nostalgia, which is the worst kind of nostalgia. But the film looks fascinating. So
my God,
Brian's not going to get over that.
No, I'm a legitimately great. Never mind, it doesn't matter. We can talk about it when the movie comes out.
Anyway.
God, if I had known this 100 episodes ago. Fuck. Anyway, so that's that. We are now half an hour into this podcast. So let's talk about The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Jordan and I saw this. This will be a brief-ish review. There will be a spoiler section.
And I'm going to go put clothes in the dryer.
I wish I was doing that while I watched this movie. No.
So The Amazing Spider-Man 2 picks up where The Amazing Spider-Man sans number left off. And that is with Peter Parker graduating high school, getting ready for his future, still unsure of whether or not he should date Gwen Stacy, considering that he promised her dying father that he wouldn't. And a slew of new enemies arise, and he must battle with his sense of duty and powerlessness and, I don't know, some other stuff. Here's the problem that I'm having explaining the story of this movie, and that is that there is no story in this movie. The plot as it is, like, it's just a bunch of stuff that happens, like a series of coincidences.
There is a story. It's just not a very interesting one.
Yeah. Here's the thing. This movie is written by, Kurtzman and Orsi. That's how you pronounce that guy's last name, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And that is always going to give you a slapdash, overstuffed, incomprehensible, nonsensical film.
Yeah.
This movie is only marginally, in my opinion, saved by Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. The direction by Mark Webb is sometimes fun. And there's some honest-to-God moments in here that I feel like if you plucked them out and then used them as the cornerstones for another better movie, or maybe like three other better movies, you could do something really good. Yep. None of them work, though. This movie's it's not terrible per se, but it's not anything better than just kind of okay.
Yeah, I did think it was a step up from the last one, which I just thought I was so bored throughout. Which I understand. I mean, they have to do the origin thing again, and so like I was hoping they would do something interesting here, and there is a very bold scene that we can talk about that I quite liked. I thought that was really well handled. And probably one of my favorite sequences in the comic book movie period, which is kind of surprising. But other than that, Jamie Foxx's villain character is so poorly sketched out. And it doesn't help. I don't know what you thought of the score, Brian, but they're trying to do something. Hans Zimmer did the score, and he recruited like a bunch of guys that he dubbed the Magnificent Six, which includes like Pharrell Williams and Johnny Marr. But anyways, they're trying to do like this dubstep score, which internalizes how or externalizes what Electro is feeling,
right.
And it's so distracting and like I honestly could not believe, like, while I was sitting at the theater, I could not believe that that this was like a decision that Sony was like, yeah, this sounds great, let's release this worldwide. Like, I couldn't believe.
I thought it was a bold, interesting choice that did not work.
Yeah.
Because Electro makes a lot of noise because he's made of electricity. And it was interesting the way that they tried to bleed his diegetic noises into the non-diegetic music surrounding him.
Yeah.
So I was okay with that. His interior monologue, like an EDM Terrence Malick, was a little bit weird. But again, there's so much stupid, reductive stuff in this movie that any chance it took, I really enjoyed.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I will say, there's a few elements I liked. Yeah. I could get into those if you want me to.
I mean, like, as long as they're not spoilers. We'll get into the spoilery stuff. But, I mean, just sticking with Electro, I really liked... I hated him when he was a human. There was something so... Like, everything else in the movie is fairly grounded, but there was something so cartoonish about him. Like, just really ugly, stupid, cartoonish.
Well, even, like, it just goes to the odds with what Mark Webb, I feel, is trying to do with, like, the Gwen Stacy stuff and make it a believable like relationship, and then right. and then you jump to Electro, and it's like it's just the worst like caricature. Yeah, there's nothing. And literally, the first second he's on screen, I was like, oh shit, this is what they did. This is what they did with this character, and they did not let me down in terms of making it just the worst. Like you know, like I said, caricature, and just like his motivation is so it's just so one note that. And you know exactly where his arc is going to head throughout. Like yeah. this, literally the second he's on screen.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you can tell the arc, but I actually really liked the scene with him in Times Square.
When he's questioning, yeah, what?
Like it's kind of like a Frankenstein's monster meets, you know, a guy. It's like if Spider-Man was less well adjusted. I thought there was a really interesting dynamic they played out there, where he is a fan of Spider-Man. And Spider-Man comes and is able to, like, talk him down. But, you know, all the people in the city, they see Spider-Man, who they have grown to love, and then they see a crazy blue guy who's accidentally electrocuting cops. And so, because of the just very basic, you know, cultural idea of a superhero needs a supervillain, you know, this group casts Electro as the bad guy, and so he kind of becomes that. Like, there is an interesting kernel of an idea that I think they get half right, but then he just fixates so much on hating Spider-Man that it doesn't make any sense. Like, they really came close to doing something interesting with the way that a villain could be created,
mm-hmm.
and then they just bungled it.
I did like well, first of all, there's like a 10-minute sequence in the beginning maybe where Spider-Man's like kind of goofy and witty and kind of what you're hoping the movie will be like.
I always want out of my Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, just like going around the city, you know, making funny jokes that aren't actually as painful as what some of the lines that are to come in the movie. and just like, you know, just having fun, being like, you know, saving people. And like, I thought the swinging around the city was effective, but they really only do that like once during the movie, which is kind of weird. You would think they would kind of, you know, make that a bigger spectacle throughout the movie. And yeah, so that kind of dynamic is pulled off, I think. And then I did like Dane DeHaan, at least initially. You know, when he's on screen, he just has like a better presence, I would say, than Andrew Garfield, which is kind of a blank slate, I think.
I had a real problem with Dane DeHaan's hair.
Yes, he can't get it out of his like eyes.
It's also like his hair starts at the like middle of his head.
Yeah.
And they like have a comb forward. to match Jamie Foxx's comb over. A lot of weird hair choices in this film.
Yeah. But there's like moments where I mean, it's no spoiler that he turns into the Green Goblin, and once he goes out the deep end, it's a little too much, but right before that change, when he's just like a crazy guy jumping around, there's almost like a few like Nicolas Cage-esque moments that are really funny.
I really liked him in this film up until the point that he becomes the Green Goblin.
Yeah. And his chain, it just feels so forced in this movie, like such a quick ramp up from him being like, hey, Spidey, let's kind of, okay, I'll be friends with you. And then try to, you know, because there's this whole dynamic where Spider-Man's trying to get, or he's trying to get Spider-Man's blood.
Yeah, because he believes that it'll help save him.
Spider-Man just being genetic. A dick, like, no, I'm not even going to try that.
Well, that's the thing, like, there's so many, like, and this is the problem with the film, is that you basically have 2.5 movies smashed together. So, like, if you had had an Electro movie where you introduce the Harry Osborn character and this kind of concept of, you know, I need Spider-Man's blood to live, and then it ended with Electro being defeated, and then the next one was Spider-Man trying to help him, Harry Osborn, out, and then that turns him into the Green Goblin, and then that's, like, the motivation for him hating Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that would be good. And I feel like, you know, get some new screenwriters. But I feel like Mark Webb has a good enough handle on being able to shoot and direct interpersonal scenes. And I actually kind of like some of his action scenes, despite the use of slow motion a little too liberally.
Yeah, that gimmick. Yeah, it was kind of fun, though.
It was fun. I mean, why like, not? Yeah. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with the film. It's just that none of it hangs together.
Yeah, it's just kind of, it's tolerable, and you're like, all right, that was a That was a Spider-Man movie. Okay.
Basically.
But I will say, do you want to get into brief spoilers?
Yeah, we'll get into to brief spoilers. So if you liked the first one, I kind of dug the first one. This one was a little bit, I could see how it was better, quote unquote, but I actually enjoyed it less. I mean, that's the kind of weird netherworld we're working in with these new Spider-Man films. And I hope that the next one corrects some of that. Because, you know, we already know we're getting another one, so we don't have to live in...
Oh, we're getting more than one.
Yeah. Yeah, oh god. There's what? There's the sequel
Sinister
to this,
Six.
The Sinister Six, Venom.
Yeah.
Oh god. Anyway, so get ready. God, just fire Kurtzman and Orsi. Like, why do these guys make money? Like...
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, who cares, really, in the end? Like, it's just gonna... There's no way they're gonna make it. Like, so this is clearly Sony's... amazing Spider-Man franchise. It's not Mark Webb's Spider-Man franchise. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, they're clearly here, Mark Webb, here's the set for you, go kind of shoot this. Okay, we already know what we want to do over the next six films and you're gonna be fine, but it's not gonna be great. Like, you could tell from the first movie that it's kind of I hate to be pessimistic, but there's clearly you know, he's clearly just another piece of this huge puzzle and not the driving force behind the movie.
He needs to, like, take everything he's learned in these and go make a good movie.
Yeah, we'll see. I actually talked to him, and he just seems a little sad. Like you can see the sadness behind his eyes when, like, I was at a round table and he's talking about, like, they're talking just about, like, Peter Parker's arc in the movie, and it's just, and you're like, come on. Let's not kid ourselves. Anyways. But yeah, it's a fine movie. It's there's so much wrong with it that it's hard to recommend.
It is. It's difficult to recommend. But again, like, if you like the first one, this one is better marginally. I don't know. It's, again, it's a weird beast. But let's get into spoilers so we can talk a little bit about the plot. In deeper things.
I mean, you don't prefer to Raimi's Spider-Man 2, right?
Oh, just, no.
No. Okay. No.
All right. Would say that I still prefer both of these more than the third Spider-Man.
See, the thing is,
Spider-Man 3, I want to try to rank these in my mind. So, Spider-Man 2.
We have to do this.
Spider-Man 2, the one with Dr. Octopus, is number 1.
Yes.
Then I think I might actually go for The Amazing Spider-Man.
No.
And then I think I'd go Spider-Man. And then I think I'd go The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And then I think I'd go Spider-Man 3. So it's like a triple-decker sandwich.
Okay. I was going to say, thinking about Spider-Man 3, and I actually saw someone talk about this recently, there's been a slight... No one is reclaiming it as some misunderstood masterpiece, thankfully. But I have seen people recently, I think, kind of get the movie right, just saying that it's sort of wonderfully perverse, just in the sense that it's Sam Raimi clearly bored... and clearly not wanting to make a movie that he is being forced to make by two greedy producers. So he puts in a scene with, you know, Bruce Campbell as a French waiter, like this long extended sequence that has no connection to the film. Or he has, you know, two dance sequences, one of which has Peter Parker saying, "Now dig on this," and then snapping his fingers. It is, I mean, I do agree, it is sort of kind of...
It's intolerable.
Yeah, but no,
it's
the thing
unwatchable.
Is, but wouldn't you rather have fun asides like that rather than
this
movie
now.
That's like boom, 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 everything? Like,
no, because they're not fun.
They're
literally. I cannot sit through that movie.
The dance scene where he's walking down the street and he's like snapping his fingers and pointing at women is
finger guns
is fucking great.
No, I disagree vehemently.
No, it's great because
I can't watch it. I'm telling you that I physically cannot remain seated in a room with that movie playing.
That scene though is great because it is embarrassing and awful, and that's exactly how it should be.
Why is that how it should be?
Because it's a dork who thinks he's cool.
But a dork still knows what's cool.
No, he doesn't. No, he has no idea, and that's
yes, he does.
Because he just, you know, he's walking around and sort of spinning that scene.
This man is not. He hasn't been locked in a room without TV or music or culture. He should know what cool is.
Maybe he doesn't know how to act.
It's the stupidest argument that I've ever heard for that.
That's why it's fun. That
That's not.
It's kind of a. It's kind of a fun movie. It's just horrible. It's a horrible.
I think it's a terribly unfun film, and it's a slug, and it's horrible. So I guess we agree halfway.
I would take maybe sort of like, you know, shrug and slight smile of a film than whatever. I don't know.
That's like a guy throws a dinner party every week, and suddenly he gets tired of it, and he feeds you your mom. Like, that's not like, oh, his shrug and a wink, and he doesn't care anymore. That's like,
I don't know if it's as bad as having to, you know, cannibalize my own mother, but okay.
Depends on how much you like your mother.
Hey, at least in this one, he likes Blowout, so that's good.
Yeah.
There's a Blowout poster on as well.
Yeah, there's a Blowout poster as well.
Hey, but wouldn't that be weird if he's a huge Brian De Palma fan?
Yeah. There's also a Dogtown and Z-Boys poster on as well.
Yeah. Wow, this movie's so indie.
But we don't get to see him skateboard this time, so, you know.
Isn't there also an Ida poster?
Like, yeah, there's totally an Ida poster. Okay, so let's talk spoilers for like 5 minutes, and then let's get into our feature review of Ida. This is the most insane podcast I think that we've ever recorded.
This could be our longest episode.
It may be. So let's talk about spoilers for The Amazing Spider-Man. Jordan, you said that you had a scene that you thought was one of the most effective sequences.
Yeah, I didn't know this, but it's been in the comics since like the 70s, but when Gwen Stacy, spoilers, falls to her death, or actually is killed by Spider-Man technically.
Killed by Spider-Man?
Yeah.
I think it's more like he fails to save her.
Yes, that's true. But no, I actually really thought that scene was well done. It's the only time in the movie where I think Mark Webb effectively uses the slow motion, whereas the other times are just kind of pretty silly. But this one, I mean, if you're listening and only haven't seen the movie but only want the spoilers, he's fighting Electro's far gone and is already forgotten by like the end of the movie, which is another thing, which is just, they're like, why is he in this movie? But yeah, Dane DeHaan becomes the Green Goblin and is flying around trying to kill Spider-Man. They go to like this clock tower type thing, and Gwen is there and she's hanging, and with one foot, Peter's like trying to stop the clock tower from switching, which would make this Spidey web that he made, or I don't even know the correct terms, but anyway, she's about to fall to her death. And it snaps and she falls and we go into slow motion, and Mark Webb, I thought was effectively done. He like shows the web coming out and then the slow fall, and then boom, he catches her, but it's too late and it's too fast and she snaps her neck. And I thought that was pretty well done, and the motion that came from that. Which is the only arc in both movies that I think actually works. And so, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, we've seen that the webs have some elasticity to them.
Yeah.
And so it's like there's just enough elasticity in the web for her to smash into the floor and then get yanked back up.
Yeah.
It's a dark, dark moment.
Yes, like, and this is how these movies should be. And it's actually bad because I'm so trained from all like the horrible Marvel movies and everything else that, like, because he really focuses on her face for so long that you're like, oh, she's gonna wake up, and that, like, every other superhero movie does. And so it was really, really, really pleasing to see her die.
I know, on an artistic level, yes. It's sad to see her die because I like Emma Stone in these movies, but yeah, it was so dark because he comes down and she's hanging. And so he's like, oh, great, I saved her. This is good. Like, yeah. I did it.
Like, Mark Webb, when we talked, he said, like, this is the one thing he's wanted to do, or this is something he's planned since before he even did the first film. And I think it's, like, the one thing that he actually planned, because it's, like, their arc is the most effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was well done. And then the movie just retreats to
20 minutes of other stuff.
20 minutes of build up for the next movies, which is just so, like, if this movie ended like there's, he even does a great thing with Andrew Garfield getting over her death and it's like one of the only cool visual sequences, I would say, like, that is actually showing the time pass at, and yeah, like that kind of stuff is what I kind of expect from Mark Webb, and that he doesn't really bring until, you know, only the end.
You have to deal with that fucking rhino.
Oh, yeah.
That looked terrible. Really upsetting.
Well, the annoying part is just like either make a movie that's entirely building up, or, you know, it feels like by the end they just kind of forgot about the story they told for the last 2 hours. And like I said in my review, but like, why should we really care about the story if they clearly don't, you know?
Yeah. Well, someone else, I forget who said it, but I mean, it was something that I would have come to on my own. It's but you know, I'll give credit for them saying it first, probably because they saw the movie before me. Anyway, anyone who sees this who has also seen The Incredibles is going to have a really hard time denying that it ends just like The Incredibles does, with the Underminer like coming out of the ground and like threatening everyone and making a speech. And then this, the spoilers for The Incredibles, I guess. And then, you know, the family slapping on their masks and like just like being like, let's get to work.
Oh yeah.
It's exactly like that. That's basically Paul Giamatti is the Underminer in here. And actually, hilariously, he undermines the entire goddamn film.
Yeah. It's just, it's such a strange last 20 minutes. Cause it's like, all right, we have like 5 minutes for Andrew Garfield to get over this death and then get right back into business, and yeah, then like have another action scene, and like it's just so
there's
poorly done.
Kid in a Spider-Man costume.
Yeah. So that kind of stuff just feels so hurried and rushed, that it's, and then by the end you're just like, all right, get me out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like Get Me Out of Here is a good way to.
Yes. Perfect segue.
Perfect segue into Ida. So yeah. That's our review of The Amazing Spider-Man 2, out in theaters now. I saw this in 3D. The 3D was pretty good.
Yeah, I saw it on IMAX 3D. It was okay.
All right. Sweet. That's a good way to end this. So now we're going to talk about Ida, the newest film by Pavel Pavlikovsky. Sounds about right. This is the story of a young nun in training. What do you call that? A novice?
Yes, she's about to officially become a nun. Okay. Like, yeah, so it's
according
she's at the convent.
IMDb, it's a novitiate nun. Oh. So I'll just stick with that. Nun in training, who grew up in an orphanage and goes to meet her aunt to find out more about her family before deciding to take her vows. So Ida, a brief movie. It's only 80 minutes long, but it packs a lot in there. So let's talk about it. Nick Newman, what did you think of Ida?
Well, Ida, I liked very much. I had gone into it only hearing buzz. I had heard buzz about it from some critics who were lucky enough to see this motion picture. Jordan saw it at Sundance, I believe. And,
yes.
And some other people have just been going to these fancy advanced screenings. And so when I finally got around to it, I was actually, strangely enough, although there was quite a bit of quote-unquote hype around it, I really didn't know what the film was about at all. I actually didn't know it was about a nun until the movie started. And there's, I think that's a virtue, really, because the film delivers kind of a really surprising, perhaps even upsetting twist within its first 10 minutes. And the rest just kind of follows from there. This relatively brief visit with this woman. The film is only 80 minutes long. And while I thought that was kind of an interesting approach, it is a bit of a double-edged sword. I don't care if it's long or short just by virtue of being long or short. I just thought it was kind of fascinating that this austere Polish black and white film would only be 80 minutes long. And I do like sort of the snapshot approach this film takes to just letting us see this woman's life for a period of maybe no more than a few days and getting a rather thorough look into her psychology therein. And I think that it can provide a rather thorough psychology with that limited amount of space. Speaks well to Pavli... How do you pronounce the director's last name?
Pavlikovsky.
Pavlikovsky. How it provides this window into her life through such a short time, I thought was rather commendable. But I also kind of wish the film was longer, honestly. I feel like it could stand to gain as much as 40 minutes or an extra third of a runtime, because it seems to just move very quickly through certain events and to give us sort of these very scant details, which, although I understood that there was definitely a purpose behind these scant details, to me it just at times felt a bit too quick. And yet I was also just very engaged by Pawlikowski's really kind of his very strange shooting decisions in this film. The movie really is kind of, it's first of all, it's in 4:3, which should be noted. But also, so much of the film is just contained really in the very bottom of the frame.
Yeah.
So much of the action is just happening there, and there's kind of this feeling of, I mean, appropriately for a film about a nun, it feels like we're watching over the characters, almost this deity who's looking over these characters and judging their actions and observing them. And that's something which I found he kind of employed really well throughout. It didn't really feel as if it was kind of a one-trick thing where, you know, okay, well, things are going to be happening in the lower bottom of the frame. This is going to, you know, create a certain quote-unquote art house sensibility. That was not it at all. I mean, I found it consistently really this fascinating approach where it kind of kept me on my toes because I was never exactly sure how action was going to play out when so much of the frame is being devoted to negative space. And there's also sort of this ambiguity just in when the film is exactly set, I think. Is there not any notice as to when it actually takes place?
I think, and there's nothing in the film, but I think it's supposed to be in the 60s.
It's supposed to be in the 60s, and yet there's something about, perhaps this is my own cultural ignorance, but sort of just the black and white photography in the small Polish village setting makes it feel like it could take place at almost any time,
Yeah.
It does have a timeless attitude, except in some of the political and, you know, I guess cultural and historical things it touches on.
Perhaps so, but I mean, it's, you know, there's a pivotal character in this film who's a musician, and there's really nothing about him being a musician that would be a giveaway as to where this is taking place. And so that to me was just this constantly enveloping feeling of not only not really being entirely sure where it was going to head, but how it was going to handle itself. There's kind of this tension throughout, this very quiet, this very, I guess in a lot of ways, modest film that always feels like it's kind of on the edge of something a bit chaotic, I think, emotionally chaotic or intellectually chaotic. And so that for me, yeah, the experience was thoroughly gripping. If I have certain reservations about it, they're not at all significant enough for me to say that you shouldn't go see this film. I think you should go see this film immediately, especially because it's just such a beautiful looking movie too. So if you see it in a theatrical setting, you know, unfortunately, black and white photography is not so popular nowadays, even among foreign art house filmmakers. So to see a movie like this with this kind of black and white photography on a screen is a pleasure of its own. So yeah, I liked it a good deal.
Okay. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I have to mostly agree. I thought the film was pretty stunning. And like Nick, I sort of had this weird experience with anticipating it where I had known for some time that a lot of critics were really high on the film, but I was kind of just a little bit confused by it because I had seen Pawlikowski's previous film, The Woman in the Fifth, which is like a Paris set thriller mystery starring like Ethan Hawke and Kristin Scott Thomas. So like, I remember reading about Ida and I'm like, why is the guy who made The Woman in the Fifth making this very austere black and white film about a nun's kind of coming of age story? And so the whole thing just sort of confused me from when I first heard about it. But reading about Pawlikowski has been kind of interesting because he was born in Poland, but he's sort of like made his career in England. And so this is like his only film that's made in his native language. And so the film does have this kind of weird feeling of like being at once personal for those reasons, but at the same time quite distanced because of that visual style that Nick talked about, where everything's kind of off kilter and in the lower quadrants of the frame. And I found the visual style kind of amazing, and I would watch this film again. Like, I know Jordan said he watched this film twice, and I would watch it again just to kind of look at each shot one more time and try to like figure out more what he's doing there. But it's also at the same time got these really two compelling performances at the center of the movie. On the one hand, the nun character, who's played by a non-actor, and then her aunt, who's played by a very professional actress. And so there's an interesting dynamic there, both in the performances and in kind of the characters who are total opposites. And it's interesting, too, the way the movie, for all its austerity, it kind of plays into some familiar rhythms, like the road movie. There's even kind of like a sort of a detective angle where they're trying to figure out the past of this family. And I also think that we can get more into this because it is kind of a backstory heavy movie. So you might want to be careful with like spoilers. But I think that the way the movie handles this kind of cliched idea of like a nun experiencing, you know, illicit things before she takes her vows, I think the way it handles that is very smart and kind of avoids cliche because of the particulars of this story. So I could explain that more later on when I don't have to like be coy about it. But overall, I would definitely highly recommend this film.
Jordan Rupp.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with what you guys said. Yeah, and like Danny was saying, I did actually, yeah, I reviewed this on the site, and I watched it and was so like kind of caught up with the visuals that I like thought I missed some of the story. I watched it again, and yeah, I definitely, it wasn't a completely different experience, but yeah, it's one of those films that every frame, it's weird because usually if a film has like fantastic cinematography, I'll give it a few extra points just because I'm kind of drawn to that more so than story. Based on just kind of some of my favorite movies. And but this is a film where it's almost like too well thought out in terms of the visual landscape. It's kind of strange. Like there's just moments where I'm like, all right, is this adding to the story? And the way Nick explained it, if he was actually going for that, which I think is justified, makes it a lot more interesting.
I would go even further than what Nick said. So,
okay. Well, I can't wait to hear what you say.
Yeah.
Very interesting tease by Brian.
Oh, yes.
Brian Rowan.
It's kind of at odds with each other because you're seeing, but I guess it kind of works in the sense that it is kind of a simple story in terms of the length and what they're trying to find, which I guess, is it a spoiler to say? I guess we can wait for that.
It probably is.
All right. But just in terms of there's actually some like pretty dry comedy, which I actually enjoyed with the Anne, kind of how sarcastic she is, which I really wouldn't expect if someone just gave the log line of this movie. And so that was well done. I really like the idea of, which Danny touched on, which just, you know, like a coming of age story where there's, a lot of stakes, I would say, compared to other coming of age movies where like, you know, she's at a crossroads in her life and there's two very, very different paths. And I really like the way the film showed each side and a great performance, which I don't remember the actress's name because she hasn't literally been in anything else. So, but she gives a great performance, I thought. Highly recommended.
So I highly recommend this movie as well. I don't agree with Nick that it could stand to be longer. I think it does everything it needs to do, and that any added length would only kind of, even I think it would dilute some of the power in it.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this novice nun and her boozing I don't know how to explain her, the aunt. She's man hungry. I mean, she's just a normal person, but of course juxtaposed against this young nun, she looks like the world's worst human being. And I think that a lot of the power of the film comes from its understated way of kind of just letting that fact exist without having to prove it. You know, there's not like a scene where the aunt comes in and has sex in the bed, like across from the nun. I mean, like, there's a lot of stupid things that could have been done to really lean on the differences between these two people. But it didn't bother to go to extremes. It just kind of showed them in their resting states. And I like that. I like that a lot. That's something that I don't think a lot of movies have the courage to do. I loved the visual aspects of this film as well. Nick, you had said that it was kind of like a deity watching over these characters. I almost saw it more as when you have them in these lower corners of the frame, it's almost kind of an allusion to heaven or to the Holy Spirit or something above them. And it's giving as much space to that greater idea than it is to the actual human physical form beneath them. I think that if I were to be able to go through this film frame by frame, I could even make some kind of argument related to how that space increases or decreases for each character. And I really liked that. I liked that there was a lot of visual templating to show ascension as well. There's a scene, it's the only one that's really popping into my head right now. Well, there's two. There's one where there's a stairwell, and then there's another one where there is a road. And unlike most films where the roads are usually framed so that they're going off into the mid-distance, in this film, this road is framed so that the foreground of the road is taking up almost the entire bottom of the frame, and it disappears into these trees as a single point of light in the upper right-hand part of the screen. So that their trip forward towards this town to go find out about her past is actually framed and shot as an almost ascension upwards into the light. And things like that I really liked, and they're exactly the type of thing that I don't think enough movies make use of, where you're using the visuals as a kind of classical tool to tell the story of the story you're telling. Wow. I am so sorry for how pretentious I just sounded.
Mind blown.
Oh, God. I sometimes say stuff like that, and then I'm just like, someone should punch me.
This is the podcast where I listed Norte, the End of History, as one of the most anticipated films of the summer. So I think you're doing okay.
Okay, great. And then, yeah, in general, I mean, I liked the film. I thought that it was an interesting story. I thought that it had a lot of... I keep comparing films to fiction, literature... But it had a lot of the aspects that I think I really love in, like, a short novel. This kind of... It has this pursuit of a truth, and yet the truth is brought to them despite their pursuit anyway. It's just interesting, the way that these things work, and the way that the characters are allowed to exist within it. And there was actually a moment towards the end where I said, if this ends in a certain way, I'm going to be annoyed. But if it ends in a different way... I'm going to be very pleased, and it ended in the way that pleased me. So I always like it when a movie does that as well. So yeah, I'm very positive on Ida. Though in the movie, I just want to point this out in case anyone decides that they're going to write in about it. In the movie, it is pronounced Ida, but you know, we'll stick with Ida.
Ah.
Sorry, what could I say?
No, it's more nah in my direction.
So yeah, any further thoughts on this movie on a purely basic scale before we move into stuff like spoilers to talk about the way that it moves and the way that it ends?
I guess I would just say that the film is, it's refreshing in a way that I wouldn't expect because I, you know, for me, like a guy, okay, it's going to sound pretentious. For me, like a black and white Eastern European film is not really a rare commodity.
I mean,
I've seen...
It's true. It's 100% true.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a pretty okay amount by now. But just a film that's released this year, which kind of has... I guess when I say refreshing, I actually sort of refer to the fact that I've seen many films of this kind because it doesn't feel... You know, like the most obvious comparison one might initially bring up is like Bellatar, for instance. But this feels nothing like a Bellatar film. You know, it's nothing like Satan Tango or The Turin Horse. And as far as Polish cinema goes, you know, it's not... I mean, I think there are kind of like touches of Andrzej Wajda in there with the political undercurrent, but it's not really like Wajda. It's not really like Kieślowski. It's not really... It kind of seems to take... It seems to take some of the best elements from my favorite films of this part of the world and combines them into something new, which is really... I mean, as someone who... tends to love this kind of film, that's pretty much the highest compliment I could pay it. And yeah, I don't know, that's something that was kind of on my mind throughout, where I could spot maybe certain influences and formalism and certain influences and kind of the thematic undercurrents which are running through it, but I was nevertheless feeling like I was experiencing something a bit different. And what's weird about this filmmaker, I didn't know this, but his last movie was this supposedly crappy Ethan Hawke thriller, The Woman in the Fifth, with Kristin Scott Thomas. And it's just kind of strange that like he made this, you know, sort of airport thriller adaptation with Ethan Hawke and Kristin Scott Thomas that looked, I mean, it looked fine, I guess. It looked maybe fine for that sort of thing. And then he makes this. I find that really fascinating. I don't know if he's some secret genius who can just jump between all kinds of... Maybe he can't do them all exceptionally well, but he can just jump from one to the next like it's nothing. I don't know. I'm curious to see more of his films now.
I feel like I had seen... I thought I had seen My Summer of Love, but reading up on it, I really don't believe that I have. So now I'm just left wondering, like, did I just hear about it a lot so much that I thought I'd seen it and I didn't? So
this director is, like, one of the great mysteries of our time.
I would say, obviously, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about spoilers for Ida. Let's talk about the way that the movie wraps up and what we think it's trying to say.
The Sinister Six reveal was out of this world. I did not expect that.
It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Does Spider-Man actually kill Ida, or is it...
I feel that she might have just been play killed off so that she could escape to the convent and live life in safety. He fought.
I see. It's all coming together.
Yeah,
all
right.
That's a very interesting.
Doc Ock in Svidestow. Anyway, so in truth... The movie ends after this whole trip. Ida goes back to the convent and then actually decides that she's not ready to take her vows. This happens at the same time that her aunt actually commits suicide. Ida goes back to the house that her aunt had very quickly, decides to take up some of her aunt's bad habits, lights a cigarette. I was actually pleased. I've seen a lot of people smoking their first cigarettes, and that girl got it right.
Really?
Yeah, like there's not like the hacking cough and like the, oh my god, I could never do this. There is like the slight cough and then like the tentative going back and it's a little bit better, but then at the end there's still a cough. So that was good. That was good acting. She also just drinks vodka straight out the bottle. which was amazing. And then after the funeral for her aunt, she brings home the jazz musician, the saxophone player, and they spend the night together, and then she goes back to the convent after asking him, you know, what do you want to do? And he's like, oh, come to America. And, you know, he lays out like this life for her in a half joking way. But then he says, you know, life, like the usual life.
Happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she dresses back up in her habit and goes back to the convent, presumably, I would say, to take her vows.
Yeah. This ending really worked for me, and it's funny because, like, if you were to tell me, like, this movie's about a nun's coming of age and sort of discovering the world, and then you list the events of that climax, and it's, like, within 5 minutes, like, puts on a dress, gets drunk, has sex, I'd be like, that is the stupidest, like, movie. Like, there's no reason for me to see that. Like, that's just been done so many times. But what's really haunting about it is how it's framed by the aunt's suicide, which is itself rendered in like that really haunting scene and a really quick moment. Because what's interesting about the film is it is like very much a two-hander. So they're like equal characters, really, even though Ida is in the title. And so once the aunt dies and then Ida goes and does all these things, it's not really because she's scared of becoming a nun and she wants to like know what this stuff is like. It's more because she's like mourning her aunt in this really weird way. Because presumably if you're an aspiring nun and you meet this aunt you never knew you had and you spend all this time with her talking about these really intimate things and then she kills herself, you're probably going to have an epiphany that's more profound than just, oh, I want to have a cigarette before I take my vows. So I thought that was really handled well and kind of made the ending work for me in a way that kind of a more conventional narrative situation wouldn't have.
Well stated.
Yeah. Should we save the basic gist if people just want to get the spoilers, because we didn't even explain
the secrets and stuff.
All the secrets that she learned. Yeah,
I thought that was really interesting. How?
Okay, well, yeah, jump into that, Jordan.
Yeah, so she learns by visiting her aunt that she is actually Jewish, and her parents were killed in World War II. And it's her. She goes on this road trip to figure out, what exactly happened. And and so I kind of like that the dichotomy in terms of, I don't know. I kind of took away that the movie was trying to say, like, we can kind of examine the past, but it's not something to kind of get wrapped up and lost in. Did you?
I would say yeah, because she finds out she's Jewish. And I would assume that the convent she's entering might be Eastern Orthodox. Not only has she learned about the past and how her parents were killed, and the only thing that saved her is that she was young enough that she could pass as a non-Jew, she commits to a life serving a Christian God.
Yeah. And
her aunt, meanwhile, was wrapped up in all this anger and disgust because her son had actually been staying with Ida's parents.
Yeah, and it's really brushed over quickly in the film, but her aunt, I took it, was actually wrapped up in a lot of the... the proceedings of...
The purges, I guess?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
It's great, because like, this is what goes back to what I said earlier about just existing and getting a snapshot and seeing them on the resting period, because like, you can kind of build in your mind this history of her being just furiously wrapped up in the way that her son died and her sister and everything, and then throwing herself into communism as a way to kind of fight back against the wave of anti-Semitism that swept Europe that cost her family. Would they call her Red Wanda?
Yeah.
It's a dark name. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff in this movie, and it's the type of movie that sneaks up on you when you start to think back on it and see things like that. And it's really interesting. I really quite enjoyed it, and I'd recommend to anyone who has the opportunity to go see it. Nick Newman, any thoughts?
I don't know if I have much else to add. I would say that the aunt's suicide, I don't know if I was so keen on that scene, because to me it felt actually kind of predictable, honestly. As soon as sort of that shot was established and the windows open, I thought, oh, well, okay. Now it's just a matter of waiting for it. And sort of the, I don't know, I guess the manner in which it occurs to me felt a bit, again, a bit obvious. That felt like something I'd maybe seen before. That was one of the few elements of this movie that felt overtly familiar, that kind of way of handling the character's final moments. But, I mean, it's actually a small thing. I kind of forgot about it, honestly, until now. So if I wasn't so keen on that sequence, so be it. You know, the movie does so many other things right. And although it's a major, I guess it's a major event, but the way it's handled, it actually doesn't have the ripple effect you might otherwise expect, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's just one thing I want to maybe throw out there.
So any final thoughts before we leave this all behind? Great.
Hottest film of the summer.
Hottest film of the summer.
The first great movie of the summer.
I'll get behind that. Anyway, let's get into Blu-ray and DVD releases and then theatrical releases. Because of time, I'm going to say we should skip over random selections.
Okay.
Everybody cool with that?
That's just fine.
Yeah.
Great. We're also not going to have to take long to talk about what's coming out.
So let me tell you about Fritz Lang's While the City Sleeps, which I watched on Tuesday. No.
Let me spend 20 minutes. Anyway, so The Birds... Actually, okay, I don't know why I just said The Birds. Coming out to Blu-ray and DVD on May 6th, there's a lot of re-releases. It doesn't appear like there's that many new releases.
Like new movies? Well, Ace in the Hole in Criterion.
That's a re-release.
It's a film that's been on Criterion since 2007.
All right.
So what am I seeing? What am I seeing for actual new films?
Well, Veronica Mars.
The Veronica Mars movie, which I haven't seen, but I did enjoy that TV show.
Yes.
That appears to be it. The Art of the Steel?
Is
that Kurt Russell?
Yeah, Kurt Russell.
Yeah, Kurt Russell.
We gave it a mildly positive review, I think.
Generation War.
Like the 5-hour German World War II movie.
Yeah.
Which I've heard is only okay.
It's kind of it looks like.
For some reason, Universal are re-releasing some of their action titles with comic book covers.
I was getting, are those comic book covers? I thought they were kind of like that new minimalist thing that everyone loves so much.
No, that's definitely a comic book. There are panels and it's illustrated. That's, yeah.
What? Oh, I'm looking at Fox. Yeah, Universal's definitely doing that.
Yeah, I don't know why they're...
I thought it was doing it just for Wanted until I saw the Bourne Identity, Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Ultimatum, and
there's
Jurassic Park were also like that.
What in the name of God is this? This Rocky cover? What the fuck is that? That is some of the worst movie art I've ever seen. Wow.
I don't even know if I'm seeing what you're seeing.
Okay, it's on Blu-ray.com.
I'm on that. Oh, wait, yeah, Stallone, Rocky. Wow, that's terrible.
Yeah.
I got you now. Anyway, so...
Good week for re-releases, though. A lot of stuff I'd like to
see. I was about to say, a lot of good re-releases. You got the Universal action titles, which, despite the comic book thing, you know, those are some good films. I really liked Wanted. I probably have said that before and been derided for it.
Mm-hmm.
Fox is also doing a similar thing with some very... I kind of like most of these covers, especially 28 Days Later. Things like Raising Arizona, The Day After Tomorrow, Castaway, Porky's, MASH, Max Payne. I don't know why that's thrown in there with all of them, but a lot of re-releases. Anyone want to throw out some that they particularly like?
Well, the Hitchcock ones are worth mentioning Psycho. Because The Birds.
Quite a famous director.
Rear Window, Vertigo, and Psycho are on Blu-ray. I believe this is the first time, at least the first time The Birds, Rear Window, and Vertigo are on standalone Blu-rays. So that's definitely worth mentioning.
And now mentioned it.
And East in the Hole by Billy Wilder, which is an incredible film that everybody should see. I think it nails the current media landscape so well, despite having been released in 1951. That's one of Billy Wilder's best movies, which sort of means it's one of the best movies ever made, really. Yeah, that's pretty incredible. And
agreed.
Yeah. And, you know, some
The Longest
classic,
Day,
some classic war films. Yeah. Harvey.
Tora. Harvey is a classic war film.
So, I have to say, as a male, I am very, I find it very off-putting when, like, four film favorites, guy comedies, and guys being guys.
Oh, yeah, I saw that,
pack,
too. That's,
and I just think to myself, fuck off.
Four
no.
film favorites. Comics.
You do not.
Oh, we got
you do
Watchmen,
not represent me.
Jonah Hex, The Losers, and A History of Violence in a 4-pack.
Jonah Hex and History of Violence are packaged together. That's
Jonah
wonderful.
Hex is quietly assured.
I actually kind of... The Losers was another one of those films where like it happened, and at the end I was like, well, I didn't not enjoy that.
Who considers The Losers a favorite?
Not
four
a favorite.
Film favorites.
I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about what's hitting theaters. And then we'll get into our giveaway of A Touch of Sin, speaking of Blu-rays and DVDs. So coming to theaters, we got May 9th, Neighbors. This is hilarious. Oh, you saw it? How can you give us a...
I
generally
positive? No embargo or anything. Yeah, I was pretty mixed on it. Slightly positive, I would say. It's It definitely is his shortest movie, which is good. Nicholas Stoller, who lasted 5-year engagement, which felt like it was 3 hours. It's just a very basic premise, and it doesn't really do much else with it, but it's fun.
I feel like I need to see this because I have a friend who's currently living this movie.
Oh, okay. Is he the frat guy or the...
He's the guy with the baby.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's he and his wife, and they have a 2-year-old daughter, and... there's like a fraternity satellite house next to them. It was funny because I couldn't get to sleep on Thursday. I actually woke up at like 3 and I was like, well, let's see what's happening on Facebook at 3 a.m. And he had posted a status that was like, you know, 3 a.m. on a Thursday and the frat house next door is still going.
This is
the cops.
Movie. Yeah, this is definitely his movie then. Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. He said that at least 10 of his friends independently have posted the trailer for this movie on his Facebook wall.
Yeah. It actually doesn't go, like, there's a few moments where it does go to, like, the crazy lengths, but it doesn't actually, you kind of wish they went a little bit further with it, but I did like how they kind of, it's a weird structure, because it's kind of, they do poke fun of, like, frat life in a really, really interesting and funny way, But then there's all other sequences which feel like they're out of Project X, which was like, did you see that film? Yeah, the
I know of it. I didn't.
Yeah,
see
yeah,
it,
that's obviously. Like pro party, like yeah, just like right to the end, and there's no like yeah, and it's just made for that kind of group, and like Nick and Danny who are in college, they're just, it's just made for them. Yeah. And no, but so there's some
yeah,
sequences
I can see Danny
like
going to an all night rave and just fucking wilding out.
Yeah, Project X was kind of revelatory for me.
But it's just a weird mix because there's like Zac Efron has like a character arc that's really funny where he's like really really dumb and he kind of realizes it and
I just like the way that you put that. He's really dumb. Yeah. And
well, his character. And yeah, and he sees like Dave Franco going off and like going to job fairs and stuff, and he's like, like maybe I should do something, and so that
we want to see this movie more.
Yeah, so that aspect is funny, but then there's other scenes where it's like, yeah, let's go, and not in like a winking kind of way, just like a crazy like you know drunk bash or whatever you want to say.
Well, it'll be interesting. I can't wait.
But no, it's definitely an enjoyable 90 minutes, but it's not like
like This Is the End where it's
yeah it's, well that movie was like, kind of overstated as welcome a little bit but
oh,
yeah, a little
you,
bit
Jordan.
No I did like it overall better though.
All right.
But yeah no it was just fun. Yeah,
cool. So other things coming out, something called Chef directed by Jon Favreau.
Yeah, you haven't heard of this movie?
No, what?
Come on. It's another South by Southwest premiere, like Neighbors.
Oh, good.
So you know it's going to be great. No.
Yeah, totally.
No, we reviewed it. We
it
liked
starts
it
a food truck. Okay.
Yeah. It's in our review, we said it's kind of like Jon Favreau going back to his like indie roots, I guess you could say. And there's a lot of nods in the movie because his character in the movie is kind of doing the same thing. Like he used to be this top restaurant chef, and he now is opening a food truck. And yeah, I know it sounds very boring.
is it okay?
But yeah, I mean, we liked it. The reviews are pretty swell. And
I will never see this film.
Yeah, this is not this is not a Nick Newman movie, I don't think.
What else is coming out? Mom's Night Out, God's Pocket. God's Pocket has a great trailer. I've heard it's not that good, though.
Yeah, we didn't really like that. Sundance, I didn't see it though. And then, but The Double, which should be on everyone's radar, and you can VOD
yes,
it.
That'll be hitting
same day. So don't go out and see anything. Just
and next week we will be talking about Locke and The Double. So it'll be a really crazy indie weekend for us, aren't they all? So look forward to that. Now let's talk
indie
about
weekend. Whoa!
Yeah. And then soon enough, hopefully, we will do our drunk cast on The Ninth Gate.
It's got to be a really bad weekend, like maybe the 30th when Maleficent and A Million Ways to Die in the West come out.
Okay, I'm down with that.
That sounds, yeah.
That's also shortly after my birthday, so good times.
Oh, no, instead of that week we're doing Devil's Knot. I forgot.
Okay, so Jordan, why don't you clue in our fine listeners on how they can win a Touch of Sin Blu-ray?
Yes, so by the time we're listening to this, you should probably already have seen in our feed that we had a little tweet that said if you retweet that tweet you will be entered to win. So it is at Film Stage Show. Just look at the feed, you'll find it, and yeah, just retweet that tweet. You had to follow Film Stage Show and just retweet that tweet, and you'll be entered, and it'll probably run for like a week. So if you are catching up this by next weekend, you probably still have a chance to get it. And yeah, it's like we said, a great movie, so you'll want it.
Yeah. 2 out of 3 Film Stage Show hosts agree. One of the top 10 films of last year.
Well, did you see it, Brian?
I didn't get a chance to see it.
Oh, well then.
I was going to say that. I was going to say, and the third guy didn't see it. And I really wanted to.
Brian, maybe you can win.
Oh, God, could I?
No.
Damn it.
No.
It's a movie that gets away with literally hitting a character over the head with a central metaphorical component.
Cabbage?
So. No.
Cabbage.
I don't know why I chose cabbage.
Is that a Stray Dogs reference?
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
No, there's a scene, there's like a 10-minute scene in Stray Dogs where a guy eats cabbage.
You are really selling your pick.
You told me that. I remember that now. Maybe that's where the cabbage came from. Good Lord. Anyway, so that's it. We're not going to have random selections this week. Follow us on Twitter, see what we watched. Speaking of which, Jordan Raup, why don't you tell us where you can be found online?
I can be found at JP Raup, as well as the Film Stage. I tweet a lot there. So.
Killer. And Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman and the Polish nun convent.
That was, are you sure you don't want to try that again?
No.
All right. Danny King, what about yourself?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin, and ida.com/film/Polish.
Okay. You can find me at my personal site, dearfilm.net. Of course, I'm also on thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Brian J. Rowan. And dropping into a vat of electrified eels and getting bitten until I get superpowers. So thanks for joining us. Tune in next week when we will be recording and reviewing Locke and the Devil.